Welcome back to your favorite podcast about data and general geekery. This week, we have an interview. It's going to be cool. My name is Chris.
My name is Vidya.
So, Vid. This week, we have an amazing interview with a badass guest. And I bet that if you listen to the whole episode, you will come away with a new skill and new knowledge that you didn't have before.
We're like
a MOOC.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty
great. New knowledge. Yep. Totally.
Nice. That was a nice little slip in there. That's amazing. So what am I going to be learning? Who is it?
So have you ever done like a survey? You know, you had to do a survey for work or something like that.
Oh, God. Yeah. Like a million times. Survey Monkey or whatever, right?
Yep. Same here. And have you ever actually taken the time to learn how to do those surveys properly?
Properly, do you mean like following like a scientific protocol?
Exactly.
never have I ever followed a scientific protocol, unfortunately.
Same here. Exact same here.
Wait, same and here. So, you're like a scientist.
Who spends time learning surveys? Turns out we should all have done that a long time ago. I don't know. I just went to SurveyMonkey and like jammed out some questions and then like got answers and that kind of stuff, which was not the best way of doing it by far,
right?
Apparently.
It's like all leading questions, like, don't you love us? Yes. Mm-hmm. Or really yes.
Yep. That's exactly how it was. So today we have an interview with Dr. Frauke Kreuter, who's an expert in survey methodology. And we talk about all how to do a survey and where all the pitfalls are and like everything about that. Totally practical, totally awesome. That's great, eh?
You know what? I think this is surprising that we haven't done this sooner, because hello, we're a data podcast. Usually data gets collected through surveys, and we're like, what? It's like year two or something, year three. I don't even know. We've waited way too long. And all this time we've been like screwing up, I'm sure. I can't wait to hear what we're supposed to be doing right. Hopefully it's not super complicated. I'm a little bit intimidated already.
No. It's totally awesome. But first, before anything else, a word from our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by Data.World, the social network for data people. Discover and share cool data, connect with interesting people, and work together to solve problems faster at Data.World. Did you know that you could add files via URL to your datasets on Data.World? Data.World's API allows you to pull live survey data into your dataset, enabling automatic file updates and more. Get the full details on Data.World's API at docs.data.world or search Austin Cycling Survey on Data.World to see live survey syncs in action with Ralph Prieri's dataset. And with that, on with the interview.
Hi, my name is Frauke Kreuter. I'm the director of the joint program in survey methodology at the University of Maryland. And I guess on the side, I'm also a professor at the University of Mannheim doing statistics and methods there. So that's the nutshell.
So for everyone who doesn't know, you know, explain what is survey methods.
Okay, well, everyone knows what a survey is, and many people think it's as easy as you ask a question, you get an answer, and then you have some data. But there's really much more to it. It starts with defining the population, it starts with defining a concept that you want to measure, and you have to put a lot of steps, a lot of process into place in order to get to the answer. And we are studying the quality of the process, we're trying to improve it. And there are a lot of engineering pieces in there. And so that, I would say, is what we call survey methodology. Yeah.
Okay, so, you know, this is something that I've really run into where people don't really think about how to do surveys because they don't really do surveys. You know, like a lot of people who work in industry don't really do surveys that much. And then they're tasked with doing a survey and they kind of go, oh, wait, this is a really huge field. with tons of different facets to it and tons of literature on how to do it well and all that kind of stuff. You know, do you find that there's a lot of people who do surveys wrong or do surveys in like a way that is less than ideal?
Yes. Unfortunately, I think that is the case. And I can't blame them because, you know, it feels like you're just asking a question, and we do this every day. Right. And after age 3, people lose the ability to not answer a question. So you will also always get an answer, right? In day-to-day life, when you ask a question. And so the thought that it's not as easy when you do the standardized, I think is difficult to come around. And the problem with these standardized surveys is that people have to understand your question without any chance for back and forth between you and what do you really mean. And, you know, when we talk, you can do that, or I can do that. But in a survey, you usually cannot.
So, you know, along those lines, like a lot of people I know use, you know, SurveyMonkey, and they make some survey really fast. Is there like one or a few things that you think that people should look out for when they make a survey, right? So you're like, I'm a data scientist. I've been tasked by my boss to survey customers. I go to SurveyMonkey, and then I sort of have the question box in front of me, or say I'm designing the first survey. Like, what's the trap that everyone seems to fall into?
People make their surveys way too long. And it's because you usually talk, I mean, you have a couple of people that you try to please or try to, you know, give input to. And everyone has a question that they ask. And so what's often not done is think before you finish the questionnaire, how you will analyze the data. So that's why the customer satisfaction, that might be an easier one, although it's, we'll come back to that in a second, but you know, if people would get into a habit to really write down or mock up tables and graphs and regressions on how they would analyze the results, I think we would see a lot of surveys being much shorter, because you realize you don't need all the questions that are on there.
Oh, that's interesting. So, you know, in your mind, you would say sort of mock up the analysis that you want to do first, and then go back and create a survey that provides you with that data.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously one step initially, and that's sort of, you know, where I actually use customer satisfaction or satisfaction with my classes when I teach them as an example. The very first step, of course, is that you need to be clear about what it is you want to measure and how you break that down in sort of sub-dimension about which you can ask a question, right? Because you know, how satisfied are you? That's pretty broad, and it's probably much broader than what you want to know. You want to know if, you know, take this podcast. Are they satisfied with the sound? Are they satisfied with the content? You know, maybe you actually want to know if the sound, you know, is too loud, or, you know, too soft, or what have you. So usually you want to know things much more specific than this general concept. So getting these dimension and sub-dimension sorted out can be quite a task. But then even after that, when you start developing the first set of questions, you know, before you program them, I would definitely say that's the moment where you want to mock up your analysis table before you settle on this is the set of questions I want to ask.
Okay. So step, you know, build up your analysis first, then go back. How many questions, you know, is there some kind of like study or group of studies around? Maybe like people will spend 10 minutes on a survey and then not 11, or is there a big drop off after a certain number of minutes or number of questions?
Depends a lot on the mode. So if I talk to a real person, if an interviewer comes to my house, a lot of surveys manage to have these guys sit there for an hour. No problem.
Wow.
Right. but if it's on the phone, you know, people might get antsy after 15 minutes, and on the web, maybe after 5. Right. So it very much depends on the mode. But that's not the only thing. It also depends on how engaging the whole thing is. So it's it's hard to give a general rule on how long this can be. That's why we often advise to do pretests and see, you know, monitor that before you expose your entire, you know, set of respondents to the survey. I mean, the shorter the better. That I think is a given. But you know, if you go through the trouble and send an interview to someone's home and make an appointment and all that, then, like, you know, there's sort of an incentive to not just ask two questions.
So what would be sort of the structure for setting up a pretest? Because this kind of intrigues me, the idea of not just doing a survey, which is frankly probably what everyone who doesn't know what they're doing, including me, would do. Just like, yeah. Oh, yeah, survey, send it out. So what would be the thing that I would look for if I was setting up a sort of a pretest of it that I would want to, you know, like sort of catch and then change when I did the full survey?
There's sort of two different types that we usually recommend or talk about. The first phase would be you test whether the questions can be understood. So you ideally find a few people from your target group and give them the question, and then afterwards ask, you know, maybe ask them to repeat the question back to you in their own words to check if they understood what you tried to ask. Or you talk to them afterwards about their answer and, you know, see if that really gets to the concept that you try to measure. So that we call cognitive pretesting, where we really try to get sort of at the cognition process. The other piece, which is where you monitor drop-off and excitement, you would feel to a larger set, but still not a whole lot, maybe 50 or 100, you know. And there you would, if it's a web survey, you could track all kinds of stuff. You could track the time it takes to answer a certain question. You would monitor break-offs. Right now we're doing research on capturing mouse movements. You could see if people, you know, move back and forth between answer options and trying to decide, stuff like that.
So I have my pretest, and I should actually put the questions out and give them to some group of people, hopefully that I can then talk to and be like, okay, do you understand mm-hmm. this question? All that kind of stuff. Are there types of questions, like open-ended questions or closed-ended questions or like multiple choice that are particularly do well in general and do particularly poorly, like in your end analysis?
So open-ended used to be pretty tough because you need to code the open-ended answers. And I guess even nowadays, even if you can employ machine learning, at some point you need some training data for the text you have and to help with the coding task. So in general, open-ended, I think, is good to use sparingly, unless you have a good plan or, you know, folks that do text analysis in place in order to code that. If you do it on the web, people try to stay away from grid questions. I always get a kick out of United's post-flight surveys. At the beginning, they had, you know, grids that were so large that you couldn't see them on the cell phone screen. And so by the time you get to, you know, scale 0.7, you don't longer know which category you're answering about. So stuff like that, you know, can be pretty common.
I like the multiple choice. I think that United example is pretty amazing because I've actually seen that on my phone when they send you the email after your flight and you have to like click it. Is there... You know, one of the things that's come up a few times for me is I have a tendency to ask leading questions when I've written surveys, which people have repeatedly pointed out to me on numerous occasions. Yeah, how bad of a problem is leading questions? And is there a way that I can sort of get around that in a better way, or at least catch myself when I'm doing it?
Yeah, so it's funny. I've noticed that being years in this profession, even in regular conversations, I now tend to ask much more balanced questions than I used to in the past. You know? Like, I mean, I don't preface everything I say, like, do you favor or oppose? But sort of pushing yourself for balance, and in particular when you have, I mean, you can do that through the answer categories, but also in the question itself, that you sort of allow for the opposite and state that. I think you can practice that, and that's certainly a good task.
So we have, I'm in my head, I'm building a fictional partially derivative survey, which we are thinking about doing. And so I should take my survey, I should hand it out to, you know, some friends. It should be short that people will spend some time on. It should probably not be open-ended because I don't think I'm going to do a lot of NLP on on the answers. You know, one thing that's actually come up for me before was having really long questions, I guess really, really complicated sentences in questions that lead to like a very, like, one time, I'm trying to remember this, it was like, you know, like, what do you feel about James, comma, the guy who ended up doing X, mm-hmm. comma, and I think that's a really important thing, comma, you know, like, it's like a little, it's like a word problem, and you're trying to, like, between it, it's like a reading comprehension test, and then at the end of it's like, do you agree? And you're like, I don't know, maybe.
Yeah. Well, we have that problem a lot, and I think that's why you want to do this pretest, because you would find, you know, if you watch people, you know, wrinkle their forehead, you know something is going on, and this is hard to read. And if you ask about your own stuff, in particular, if you ask about stuff that you're excited about, you will not notice that this is hard to read. Another good self-test is reading this out loud or over for the phone to someone, because that's the hardest way, right? Keeping attention if you don't read it and hear it at the same time. So there are sort of a couple of ways you can catch yourself, but the shorter the better, no doubt, you know. And sometimes it's better to ask two questions instead of one long, convoluted one.
So I'm breaking my hypothetical question up into different parts. I have noticed when I've taken a few surveys, this is probably bad to admit to someone who does surveys, but I tend to pick the first answer or some middle answer because I'm rushing through to get really fast. You know, like I'm just kind of like running through it and I don't really care that much. Is there a way to detect my bad behavior? Like, is there sort of any kind of method in place to detect people who are answering the questions but aren't really actually answering the questions?
Yeah, so you make a great point here, and I have two answers to that. The first one is a lot of survey platforms these days actually allow you to randomize the answer categories. And to the extent that the answer categories don't need to be in a specific order, in order to make more sense, you know, like years of education, you wouldn't randomize that, right? That makes it harder. But if it's sort of neutral categories that could come in any order, like in a ballot on when you go vote, randomizing is a good thing because this tendency to pick the first one, you're not alone. But if you can't randomize, and if you have 5-point scales and lots of those questions, we do see people getting tired or making this easy and do something what we call straight lining. And so analyzing your data, not question by question, but across questions and seeing if there's sort of an answer pattern that people display. Some just move from upper left to lower right and then back, you know, like a zigzag, or I mean, there are sort of patterns that people do if they don't read and just answer. And you can detect that, obviously. But you have to have the idea of analyzing the question sort of as a set rather than individually.
Wow, okay. I never really thought about that. So what you're saying is that we should, the only time I've ever analyzed a survey, I just did it question by question. Like, I took each question as sort of an atomic unit. Mm-hmm. And then made a chart or some kind of simple analysis that you know, reviews that question. So you're saying instead I should use all the questions as a whole to create a sort of some kind of, you know, context or some aggregate picture of a person, and therefore you would be able to see probably like how they think about things in general, but also if they're doing some very simple patterning of always choosing the first answer or something like that.
Right. I mean, you know, it's sort of within person variance, right? If you want to express it in statistical terms. And but they can pay patterns too. I mean, you can have a lot of variance, but if it's sort of a straight line going, you know, first question you answer one and second two and third, you know, and so on, and then go back, that would be a pattern too, and shows that someone just sort of clicked mindless through it. But so exactly, you would detect outliers, and it might very well be that someone thinks the podcast is great and they will say fantastic, you know, 5 stars to every single question that you point out or give them. But if nobody or if a lot of people don't show any variation, your measurement instrument isn't that great. That's Well, your podcast is so fantastic that there's really nothing. What you sometimes do in order to catch that, actually, what people do with these long lists is that they have items in there that are flipped, so that if you think it's great, once in a while you have to answer one instead of 5. And then you would try to catch people who miss that. And I would be careful in just excluding them from the analysis, but it would be good to run your analysis with and without these people and see how much they affect what you conclude here.
Okay, so I have my partially derivative podcast. I'm gonna set up these short questions with a short number of questions. Now, this is a very, very, very sort of tactical question, but when I have used SurveyMonkey, it offers me the choice between, you know, a binary choice, 1 to 2, but then in like a range. If I could do, you know, rate how awesome the podcast is between 1 and 3 or 1 and 5 or 1 and 7 or 1 and 10, is there some kind of cognitive limit to the amount of like detail? Like I could imagine rating it out of 1 to 100 would be really weird because what's the difference between 98 and 99 in that case?
Right. I think for this kind of task, we usually would recommend 5 or 7. I mean, more and more people are used to 5. And, you know, there's sort of a big debate among survey methodologists whether you allow for a mid point category or not, or if you push people to commit, whether, you know, you don't allow them to be neutral, basically, in the middle, right? So that depends a little bit on how important for you it is to get sort of the bipolar answers, you know, and what the question is about. But in general, with these kind of things, shorter scales are probably good. The 10-point scale might be too fine-grained for what you're doing here. But there are other measurements like pain. You know, there's a big research on measuring pain. Physicians do that all the time. And they use thermometers, so, you know, some other metric that people are sort of used to, and have people answer on scales like that, and that works too. But they feel like they have more, you know, they need more choices. So, I mean, depending on what it is, if you measure emotion, if you measure pain, five points won't do the trick often. That's sort of the reason.
I have to go back to this. You've intrigued me with this idea of the middle category. So, not knowing anything about surveys, that would be that if I was doing a sort of 5-point scale, there would be two, there'd be one and two, and then three would be the middle, and then four and five would be on one side. So there's like a neutral, you could sit in the three and sort of be neutral. What are the arguments on both sides of that? That kind of blows my mind. Wow.
Well, so if you don't have a middle category, right, then you push people to decide on which side they fall, right? And you could argue that everyone leans towards something, and the middle is just the easy out. And so if you don't allow that, then you'll get at least the tendency. I think that's sort of the point of the debate. I personally think one should allow middle categories, but but it does depend a little bit on the topic, of, you know. So there is a debate also that's sort of related to answer providing. Don't know category. I mean, on knowledge question, obviously, same issue, right? I mean, there's certain people just don't have an opinion on a topic, and I feel like rather than them making one up on the fly, I would filter those out.
So yeah, what are the sort of the best practices around one, don't know answers, but also I think, you know, something that I've sometimes had a hard time actually answering is things like other, right? So, you know, like, yeah, or whatever, you're blue, you're green, or you're other. And then I get a bunch of replies in the other. Obviously, I should have had more answers available for that particular question. But, you know, is there some kind of good practice around dealing with others? Should we not include them? Should we definitely include them? Anything like that?
Well, that depends on the pretest piece, right? If you feel like you have a mechanism with which you capture most of the different categories, I mean, you know, the lay of the land here, right? Then that will be a good thing. But sometimes it's just too much. I mean, think of a small phone device and you... Well, now I have a hard time coming up with good examples outside the college world, but... You know, different majors or what have you, right? I mean, there can be long lists if you don't allow for an other. And if you think that most of your respondents fall into a small subset of categories, it's good to scope that out, ideally through these pretests and talking to your actual audience, and then do allow for other, you know, so that... And with the... I mean, one thing is interesting with the other, if there's a box where you can write stuff in, people will... I mean, we'll tailor the answer depending on the length or the size of the box that you have to write in stuff. So that's another little trick to remember.
So, wait, let me just see if I got this right. So if I could answer yes and just, you know, like it would take me half a second to click yes. But if I clicked no or other, I'd have to like write a block of text explaining why people will just skip that or something.
No, okay. I mean, if it's yes and no and other, well, it's hard to imagine what question would that be. But no, I was more thinking in terms of, you know, let's say, what topics do you want to hear on the podcast, right? And then you have a couple of default, I mean, like five or six different ones and then others. And so, you know, if the others is just a short text box, then they will write, you know, shorter things, and it's actually you're more likely to get text in that text box if it is not a big box where you feel like you have to write a whole, you know, novel too.
Oh, I like this. Okay, so I'm gonna make a question. I'm gonna have people say, hey, what kind of topic should we talk about? And I should have a short text box. So people are fooled into writing, thinking it's not a huge commitment to write. Is that the idea?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it fooled, but it's sort of, this whole thing should feel easy.
Now I have it totally in my head that I'm going to do a partially derivative listener survey. As, you know, as a form of free consulting on air right now.
Right.
You know, do you have any tips for how I should do this survey? And then, you know, the listeners will now see the survey that will come out and how closely I was able to follow those.
Well, one thing that people often forget when they start doing this, start with something that the listener is interested in and wants to tell you about. So a lot of surveys, or our students, they when they ask them to design a survey, they often start with asking the demographics at the beginning. Because they want to know, I mean, in your case, you would want to know your listenership. But that people don't want to necessarily talk about at the beginning, right? They want to, you know, contribute. I mean, they said yes to the survey because they like your podcast and they like the topics on it. And that's sort of the topic they want to talk about. They don't want to talk about themselves at the beginning. So that's, you know, something you could keep in mind. You know, something people often don't think about.
Okay, awesome, awesome first question. That's what we're gonna go with. I have to think of one. It'll be awesome. I'll take some time. Just so everyone knows it's gonna be a cool question. Now my last who's your favorite host?
There you go.
There will be a partially derivative survey going out. It'll have an amazing first question. It'll be short. I will not add leading questions. I will have probably five, if we have a multiple choice button. We'll have five. Done. This has been awesome. Thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show. And I'm sure our listeners will absolutely appreciate this with all your knowledge that now you've created a cohort of thousands of people who are 10 times better at surveys than they were when we started. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Sounds great. Thank you, Chris.
Well, there it was. Huge thanks to Dr. Kreuter for spending the time talking to us. But Vid, you know how we always wanted to do a proper listener survey?
OMG. I mean, is this what I think
it is? It might be. I mean, we have tens of thousands of people who listen each week. And we, you know, we hear about some of you via email and we hear about some like via Twitter. But like, we actually don't really have a great idea of who all these people are. We just know that there's lots of downloads that are happening.
Yeah, we're pretty much like flying totally blind here.
And that changes today because I did it. I took the great doctor's advice and I created our first true listener survey. It has all of the rules that she said. It has an interesting first question. It has a small number of short, non-leading questions. We use a 5-point scale. It has been pre-tested by other data people. Boom.
Dude, this is amazing. I can't wait to hear. You know what? I really do. I totally agree. I think we need to have a better relationship with. But surveys, I mean, I really love all the anecdotal emails and like tweets we get. So I hope that the survey, I hope that the survey will like, you know, get us in front of more of our listeners and hear, you know, so we can hear what they're thinking about.
I mean, I think one of the big things that we've had is that we are recording the podcast sort of assuming that we know what people will like to listen to. And that's a pretty big assumption that we've never really fleshed out. But today we are. So, dear wonderful listeners, I, Chris, humbly ask you to take 2 minutes and fill it out. It is at tinyurl.com/partiallyd. That is tinyurl.com/partiallyd, and it takes 2 minutes. And if you listen to the podcast and runs like I do, we'll post the link all over our Twitter feed. So please do us a solid, fill it out, and then send us a tweet critiquing how badly we followed Dr. Kreuter's advice.
I know, it would be great. Also, I pronounce it tiny, so I don't go to T-E-E-N-Y, it's T-I-N-Y, and Chris is like such an innovator, he keeps innovating on how this thing is pronounced.
What do you mean, teeny?
It's tiny.
It's teeny. Okay.
Well, T-E-E-N-Y would be teeny.
We're not sending everyone to, like, teen surveys. Fine, tinyurl.com.
So good. You know, I know. We should actually, though. Wouldn't that be fun?
Justin, like, Bieber.
Yeah, exactly. Like, no, which, like, are you a real fan? Prove it. This is great, though. I'm really super excited to hear what the results are going to be.
Yeah, so am I. And if you want to dive deeper into survey design, Dr. Kreuter has a course on Coursera right now on survey design, which we will link to in the show notes. And next, a word from our other great sponsor.
Wait. Before we leave, I wanted to ask a quick question. How long will the survey be open for?
I don't know. We didn't talk about that. The survey will be open for an unspecified period of time. I don't know. Should surveys only be open for a specified period of time? I don't know.
Well, then how do we know when to, like, make decisions and not, like, enough? Once we get enough responses, we're like, okay, thanks. Or it's just ongoing. It's just like an open-ended survey that never ends.
I don't know. maybe we'll leave it open for 2 weeks.
Yeah, let's do 2 weeks.
I apparently did not answer that. I didn't ask that question. That's a great question, which I did not ask her. Thus, I don't have an answer for that.
Let's just make it up. Let's say 2 weeks. How about that?
Okay, it's a 2-week survey. Totally professional. We know exactly what we're doing. That's the optimum time based on science or something.
Oh, God. Okay.
All right. Now a word from our sponsor, Periscope Data. Periscope Data was designed specifically for data teams. They turn complicated data requests like SQL queries into awesome analyses that you can share with your whole company, embedded in web pages with a link or via email, all in seconds. It does a bunch of handy SQL stuff like auto formatting, auto complete snippets, SQL views for all you hardcore SQL folks. And it's backed by Redshift, so it's super fast. No setup cost or time. Traditional BI tools take months to get your ETL configured. With Periscope, all you need to do is connect to your database and you can start analyzing your data right away. Now for a special swag offer, just visit periscopedata.com/PD to sign up for a free trial and receive one of their famous mugs with enough coffee to get you running as fast as they do. So go get one. It's periscopedata.com/PD. Well, that is everything for this week. We hope you like what you heard. You could be awesome and go rate us on iTunes. That really helps us, you know, find other people, or I guess other people find us. We will be back next week with another episode. Meantime, you can follow us on Twitter @PartiallyD. You can follow Vidya @Vid_Spandana. You can follow me, Chris @ChrisAlbin. I remembered my name there. Have a great week, everyone.
Oh, see ya.